Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. My name is Ron Yates and I'm pinch hitting this morning for David Inge, who is taking some vacation time. Normally I'm over in the Department of Journalism here at the University of Illinois, but today I'm guest hosting. So also today we're going to be talking about a topic that concerns all of us, that's national security, and in particular national security in the 21st century. Since the end of the Cold War, it's been suggested that U.S. defense policy has been formulated on an ad hoc basis without a clear underpinning. This piecemeal way of doing things has caused problems and frustrations both at home and abroad. Our Congress, military, allies, adversaries, potential adversaries seem to be confused about the lack of consistency. Perhaps this lack of consistency is inevitable given the changes in the international political and economic system since the end of the Cold War. After all, there is no more evil empire, as the Soviet Union was known during the Reagan administration, and indeed, for most of the 18 years that I spent as a foreign correspondent with the Chicago Tribune in Asia and Latin America between 1974 and 1992, U.S. foreign and security policy was one of containment, specifically containing the Soviet Union and communism. Today, the world is no longer just a push of a button away from mutually assured destruction, the way it was when the Soviet Union and the United States had thousands of ICBMs pointed at one another. Or is it? That is just one of the topics I'd like to explore with our guest today. He's Mr. Michael Lexon, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Multilateral and Conventional Arms Control in the Bureau of Arms Control. Mr. Lexon is on the campus of the University of Illinois for a foreign policy town meeting that will examine national security challenges for the 21st century. The town meeting, which begins at 2 p.m. today in Folinger Auditorium on the south end of the UIUC Quad, is jointly sponsored by the U.S. Department of State and the Office of Continuing Education at the University of Illinois. Mr. Lexon is the keynote speaker, and along with several other experts on the issue of national security, he will be available for a question and answer session. But for those who have tuned in to Focus 580 today, you won't have to wait until the town meeting this afternoon to ask questions about this critical topic. You can do it during the next 55 minutes. Welcome to Focus 580, Michael.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, let me get to the questions. The questions rolling here by asking a couple of them right now. Those of you, by the way, you're invited to join in the conversation by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening in on the Internet. Those numbers, again, are 333-9455 locally and toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let me begin by going back to my little intro here and ask you kind of a long question, which talks about the demise of the Soviet Union in 1990 and the fact that many Americans assumed that when the Soviet Union disappeared, the world was safe at last. Indeed, today America faces no readily apparent major conventional military threats or likely strategic nuclear threats, at least not that I know of. At the same time, there are some smaller yet dangerous challenges from states of concern in key areas of the world and a host of emerging security threats, such as weapons of mass destruction, wielded by terrorists, or outlaw states, ethnic violence, refugee problems, and failed or failing states, and the possibility of new forms of warfare, such as information technology warfare or the use of biological weapons. It's been suggested in the second congressionally mandated quadrennial defense review that the American government and the U.S. national security community are not yet organized to respond to this new world. Is this an accurate appraisal of the way things are since the end of the Cold War?
Well, I would say it's the first part is accurate, that the challenges are not what we were used to during the Cold War. They appeared to be simpler then, and in some regards they were, though many of the problems that you talk about existed then or were beginning to develop then, and we were starting to address them. But the primary concern that you mentioned, an ideological and geopolitical confrontation with a hostile rival superpower, armed with nuclear weapons, as you said, with ICBMs that could deliver them within half an hour or less. I mean, that is no longer with us, and therefore the other problems, which were always serious, now have greater prominence, and to some extent, I think it's safe to say that some of the problems may have been somewhat submerged by some of the discipline that at least the other side in the Cold War imposed on them. I'm thinking in particular of something like the rampant nationalism, which we've seen in the former Yugoslavia, which I don't think coincidentally emerged with the welcome loss for the most part of sort of discipline that communism imposed on those states unfortunate enough to be governed by it. As to whether the U.S. Government is organized well enough to deal with these challenges, I don't think it'll surprise you that as someone representing the U.S. government, I'm going to say I think we are well organized. I'm sure there are always ways to become more efficiently organized, and there's constant efforts to do that. If there are specific suggestions, I'm happy to entertain them.
Well, you know, recently, Senator Fred Thompson, who's a Republican senator from Tennessee, said that that states like Iran and North Korea may be able to strike U.S. territory in less than 5 years, if not already. I mean, we saw something along those lines when North Korea launched a three-stage rocket over Japan about 2 years ago, and it confirmed that, I believe. How concerned should we be about this kind of activity?
Well, I think we should be extremely concerned. The dates, I don't want to take issue with Senator Thompson, but the dates from the intelligence community, and of course all of these are estimates, I don't think the North Koreans could tell you for sure, or the Iranians, how their missile development program is going to proceed. I think we think 5 years is more or less a reasonable date to expect for the North Koreans. Iran, I think, is a little longer. But again, these are estimates on everyone's part. We do need to be very concerned. Part of this needs to be addressed with diplomacy, as I think we've had some success with North Korea. With Iran, we are working to try to have a what we call a fact-based dialogue with them on issues of across the board, including these. And then, of course, we also address this in terms of the nonproliferation approach, where countries that might be providing equipment or technology to countries of concern, such as Iran and North Korea, we deal with the provider countries in a way to discourage their proliferating these kinds of technologies. This concern also underlies the debate here in the United States about national missile defense, which is something whose controversial nature, I think, is well known. The president has made a decision that the technology development should continue, but he's not at this time. He does not at this time believe that he's in a position to make a decision to deploy a particular system. We'll have to see. The next president will have to make whatever decision is appropriate based on the facts that are brought to him.
He's effectively deferred this right to the next his successor, essentially.
Yes, in effect, he has said among the criteria he was going to use to decide how to proceed was the technology. There are other criteria as well: the nature of the threat, the cost, and then the overall impact on foreign policy. Including relations with our allies, relations with the Russians and the Chinese, the arms control regimes. But just on the basis of the technology alone, he did not feel he could make this decision. So the technology development is supposed to proceed, allowing a successor to make his own decision at whatever time the successor feels is appropriate.
Now, this is a system which I think originated during the Reagan administration, if I'm not mistaken. We called it so-called Star Wars system, right? And there was a lot of criticism of it, and also a lot of supporters. What's your opinion of this of the National Missile Defense System, and will it work?
Well,
I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well, since I'm from Washington, I spend my time getting out of spots, so I'll see what I can do. It isn't exactly the same as what President Reagan had in mind. He was talking about a system which would defend the United States and its allies against any sort of ballistic missile attack. It obviously that requires substantially more technology than what the National Missile Defense System this administration was exploring is supposed to address, because what NMD, as I'll probably lapse into calling it, National Missile Defense, was intended to deal precisely with the kind of problem you outlined a few minutes ago about North Korea or Iran or perhaps Iraq, what we now call countries of concern, being able to threaten the United States with a few ballistic missiles. The kind of missile defense that President Reagan talked about was intended to protect the United States at that time and by extension other countries, basically to make ballistic missiles obsolete. It's a very different kind of challenge and has different implications, as you might imagine. As to the technology question, I really am not the person to answer. The president made his determination based on the advice he got from his senior advisors that the technology was not in the state where he could responsibly make a decision to deploy this system at this time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what I found interesting about this, and even though this is a different system from what was created under the Reagan administration, or at least was posed by the Reagan administration, the response of the rest of the world to this system is interesting. I think earlier this month, something like 336 environment groups, peace groups, church groups, political organizations, parliamentarians, and local governments from the dozens of nations, including the U.S., have actually called on the U.S. government in an open letter not to proceed with its NMD or its National Missile Defense System. Russia and China have said that if Star Wars or NMD proceeds, they will ditch all arms control agreements to date. The European Union, the Non-Aligned Movement, the New Agenda Coalition, all these groups have they represent together the majority of the world's governments, have also stated opposition. How should the U.S. respond to this, and why are they opposed to it, I wonder?
Well, I think I'm not aware that the European Union, for instance, has formally indicated opposition to what we've done so far. Different governments have asked specific questions. I don't think it's possible to say that China, for instance, and the UK, each of which have questions, are of the same, that their questions are of the same nature. The Chinese are probably the most hostile to this, but they're hostile to a lot of things we do, not always for well-founded reasons. I think part of it is that this is something new, and there's a widespread concern among many countries, including some of our allies, that anything new needs to be thought through before you proceed with it. We have gone out of our way to consult closely with our allies, both bilaterally in their capitals and at NATO, as well as dealing with our allies in other parts of the world, to explain what we're talking about, what the nature of the threat is, why it's important, and how we're trying to proceed. I think a concern that many have is the ABM treaty, which the United States and was then the Soviet Union signed in 1972, which is a cornerstone of the arms control regime, the various arms control treaties which have been put together into an overall regime. And it is not possible for this particular system we're talking about to be deployed in a fashion consistent with the current terms of the treaty. What we have explained is that we are trying to get the Russians to agree to some amendments to the treaty, as has happened before. And on that basis, the treaty, as amended, and in our view strengthened by that amendment, could continue so that the arms control regimes could continue and stability would not be affected, or rather would be enhanced by the kind of deployment we're talking about being done in that way. The Russians have so far been less responsive than we would like, though they have also indicated some openness now and then. It's just when you actually get down to dealing with them that they haven't been as responsive as we would hope.
Mm-hmm.
None of this, at one point, I think I need to make this comment. At no time have the Russians indicated that their opposition to U.S. National missile defense is so deeply ingrained in their own feeling that they would do away with their own missile defense, which they have had deployed around Moscow for 3 decades now. Mm-hmm. That particular price is not one they seem to want to pay.
There's a little bit of hypocrisy of this in this topic. You're listening to Focus 580 on WILAM 580. I'm Ron Yates, filling in for David Inch today. If you'd like to join the conversation, you may do so by calling 333-9455 locally in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL locally or 1-800-222-WILL if you're calling long distance. The director of the CIA says that the People's Republic of China is perhaps the most significant supplier of weapons of mass destruction and missile technology in the world, or to the world, I guess, the rest of the world. As a result, you have countries around the world from Asia to Africa to the Middle East. They're rapidly building up their nuclear and missile capabilities and are being supplied in part by China. Yet recently, we know Congress approved and President Clinton will sign legislation granting China permanent normal trade relations. Some people are wondering why we should have done this, this PNTR, this permanent normal tribulations, or perhaps we should have applied a few strings to this regarding the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and missile technology. What do you think about that?
Well, it was our judgment that the best way to deal with the kind of problems you're talking about was by engagement. That's probably I should have said that some time back because you were talking about the loss of containment as a one-word sort of statement of what our policy is now. It's mm-hmm. engagement. In particular, with respect to China, we have been talking to them about our proliferation concerns for some time and had some success, though I have to frankly say less than we would have preferred. I think it's been particularly unfortunate that in response to the accidental bombing of their embassy in Belgrade by NATO last year, the Chinese broke off a number of the means by which we and others were engaged with them. And the one that took the longest to get restarted was non-proliferation dialogue. In fact, it just either last week or the week before, it formally resumed. So we are pressing them on that. As far as trying to use permanent normal trade relations or something as a stick with which to threaten them, I think we have to put the balance of where overall best interests are. And what permanent normal trade relations does is, in fact, do away with a sort of stick that wasn't, you know, that was broken, which was a formal review of their human rights practices every year before this kind of status was granted to them on an annual basis. It was clear from previous years that this wasn't working. We were going through the motions, but not actually. There was never any real threat that they would not get this kind of status. Mm-hmm. So I think it probably undercut our credibility rather than enhanced it in telling the Chinese that we were serious about things. Now that we have our permanent normal trade relations, I guess, approved and on the verge of being signed, that situation, our basic economic engagement with China, which is, let me say, it's in our economic interest, and we believe it's also in the best interests of developing China into a democratic and free market society, which should in and of itself enhance our security. Now that this is underway, I think we have a better foundation on which to have success in our nonproliferation dialogue.
Okay. We have a caller. Hello to the caller on line one. You're calling in from Champaign. You're on Focus 580. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes. In this day and age, the making of a nuclear weapon is, relatively speaking, a simple matter. Even Pakistan has managed it. On the other hand, the construction of long-range ballistic missiles remains rocket science. It involves long, costly, highly visible, and somewhat unreliable lead-ups to any possible use. And if a nuclear weapon was launched against us by a missile, of course we have systems in place that would immediately identify where it was coming from, which would lead to the conversion of the sending country into a radioactive desert an hour later. Now, my question to you is, given that spending $20 billion a year for several decades has not put the least dent in the smuggling of drugs into this country, if you were Iraq, say, and you wanted to deliver a bomb to New York or Washington, why wouldn't you just smuggle it in a commercial cargo container when it went off, it wouldn't be known where it came from? It seems to me that the whole idea of national missile defense is an immense distraction, which if we ever deployed it, the only effect would be to lead us into a false sense of security when the real problem would remain untouched.
Interesting.
Well, let me say a few things in response to that. The concern, part of the concern is that not all, I mean, we no longer use the term rogue states. I think we may have taken some some flack for changing it. It's now countries of concern. But what we're talking about is, I believe, what you called outlaw nations a few minutes ago. We're talking about countries which do not abide by what most other countries consider the standard way in which business is done internationally. Some of them have behaved in very irresponsible fashion. The stability of all of them, I think, is in real serious question. They don't have a democratic system of government which allows for a normal change of power. They're almost always countries run by strongmen who go out of their way to make sure that opposition has to be extremely covert. So you can imagine situations in which the stability of a country can begin to degrade. And if that is a kind of situation in which some sort of crisis is happening, then the control they might have over such systems, or they're perhaps feeling that the way to handle a domestic crisis is to threaten a neighbor, those are the kinds of scenarios we have to be concerned about. There are two elements to this. One is, if somehow they do launch a missile, are we really better off having that missile reach the United States with a warhead of some kind of weapon of mass destruction and causing, therefore, mass destruction? Or are we better off being able to prevent that? And do we really want the response to have to be what you said? Or can we deter them by their knowing that they can't use this at all? The other part is the concern that they don't feel they can deter us. That is what you have in a crisis, too. If they think, I would say they would be wrong, but if a country of that sort were to think that it could deter us from taking action that needs to be taken, because they believe they can threaten us with this kind of missile attack. So that's the sort of thing that we need to be concerned about. That doesn't mean that other delivery vehicles or means of delivery of some kind of weapon can't be employed, but they have different significance and different impact both on stability and America's overall security in the world. I would also say I don't think it's quite that easy to construct a nuclear weapon. I mean, at this point, not that many countries have them, far fewer, I think, than would have been anticipated 30 or 40 years ago when people were talking about a world with a lot more nuclear powers than this one currently has.
The caller raises an interesting question. We know that the number of states seeking strike capabilities outlawed by the international community is growing, and the development of this modern weaponry is not limited to these established states. I mean, look at the use of sarin gas by this apocalyptic cult, Arun Shinrikyo, in Tokyo, and the bombing of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma or Oklahoma City, and the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York. You know, I think what the caller is asking, and that's an interesting question, how should we prepare ourselves to deal with groups like these who may try to smuggle some kind of a destructive device into the country or create some kind of mayhem terrible catastrophe in, say, a shopping mall someplace?
Right, yes, and specifically, it seems to me I feel that so far the guest has not responded to my question. The matter about the nuclear weapon being simple is only in a relative sense. Relative to the difficulty of making a reliable intercontinental ballistic missile, making a nuclear bomb is relatively easy. And, as is demonstrated by the number of states that have nuclear bombs and the few number of states that have good long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. And my point is, before we even think about putting up a system whose only function would be to shoot down intercontinental missiles, shouldn't we consider the question of whether that's the likely route that one of these states that we're talking about could possibly conceive of using? It would be very difficult for them. I mean, none of them currently have long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. Their development process is going to take a long time. It's going to be inexpensive. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be complicated. And when the time comes, if it should ever come, when they want to use a missile, it's going to be unreliable just because the whole business is so difficult. And so my question is, why are we thinking of spending many billions of dollars to build a system that might lead some people to think that we're now safe against attack by such nations, when in fact it would be very simple in a relative sense for such nations to put weapons in this country hidden and threaten us later and say, if you don't do what we want, we'll blow up Washington. And I mean, as I say, the drugs have been coming in by the ton, and we've done everything we could to stop it and have not been in the least successful. And it seems to me that that's what we should be worrying about and not be worrying about missiles, which are very unlikely.
Any response to that, Michael?
Well, I fear this is going to be a situation where your caller and I probably talk past each other, because I may not have done it clearly, but I was trying to respond to his question. It is not the case that if one concern is legitimate, that the other concern, therefore, is not legitimate. We need to be concerned about both. I think these countries are trying to develop intercontinental range ballistic missiles. I assume they're doing it for some reason. It's not to threaten their neighbors. They don't need intercontinental missiles to threaten their neighbors. The assumption would be that they're doing it to try to do something with respect to someone at intercontinental range, which is likely to be us. And the primary thing which we believe they would be trying to do is to deter us from taking action that would prevent them from doing something along the lines of what Saddam Hussein tried to do with Kuwait some time back. So we need to at least consider that kind of threat, as well as the threat I outlined of states becoming disintegrating or losing some control over these kinds of systems, which, as I say, they are trying to develop.
After they have them. But it seems to me that since the process of developing an intercontinental ballistic missile is very, very visible to systems that we already have in place, if a nation that at the time we were concerned about were actually approaching having what we considered to be a viable system, wouldn't it be simpler, cheaper, and a lot more reliable to take direct action at that time rather than to build a system which of our own for defense, which in fact may not work?
I think if I understood you, you're suggesting that when a country develops a ballistic missile capability that could threaten us, that we should take military action directly against that country for having that system. I think that that isn't the best way to go. The better way to go would be to be able to render that system useless by the kind of national missile defense which we're talking about. So I don't discount much of what you're saying, but I think that you're selling a little short the need to at least explore the technologies which could be used as a basis to decide to develop such a system if that's what the next president feels he should do.
We have another caller calling in from Freeport. Hello, you're on Focus 580. Do you have a question for Mr. Lexon?
I understand he's an official of the U.S. government.
That's correct.
Is he an official? Hello?
Yes, he is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I wish if he could read some history once, I wish he could understand that since the end of the Spanish-American War, 1898, the turn of the century, U.S. corporations expanded overseas to try and make a big profit. The market wasn't that good at home. And the purpose of U.S. foreign policy in all these years, over 100 years, has been to protect these U.S. corporations, protect their big profit-making capabilities. Now, this has involved us in two world wars and numerous small wars. I wish these officials could come to their senses once and see that it's impoverishing our country, and it's created a terrific amount of human casualties as well at home among the war veterans. I don't think that we need any more military buildup. And as the previous caller stated, this these smaller states will try and what we call rogue states. Some of them may try and smuggle in a suitcase some sort of weapon that very inexpensively it could create a lot of mass destruction. You follow me?
You want to take that one?
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the caller's comments. On the, I just don't agree that U.S. foreign policy has been run by or exclusively for American corporate interests throughout the last 100 or so years. I don't think that's the reason we got into World War I or World War II or some of the other things that we've done. I think we've tried to protect America's national security and that of our allies, and sometimes we've acted out of humanitarian impulses when there were situations which didn't directly threaten our security but which we felt were intolerable. I think I also would say it is, I don't see how America is in economic ruin or whatever term you used as a result of our foreign policy. I think we're the most prosperous country in the world. We have been for 50 years, and we're certainly looking pretty strong right now. Our foreign policy, and I do need to be careful how I say this, is not intended to be anti-American business. In fact, American embassies are supposed to help American business overseas. We think that's good for business and good for America overall. It's not a zero-sum situation where American business success means everyone else does worse. In fact, the global economy is considerably larger, and I think the world is considerably better off because of much of what we've been doing.
You know, thank you, caller. While China is being blamed for selling nuclear missile technology, recently Oscar Arias Sanchez, who's the former president of Costa Rica and is a Nobel Peace Laureate, was speaking on behalf of the British American Security Information Council, and he said recently that the U.S. and Western Europe account for around 80% of the global trade in conventional weapons. Now, I don't know if this is an accurate statement or not, but he said that this is really an consistent contradiction to the rhetoric of peace and security that we hear out of Washington and other European capitals. In essence, as Sanchez says, the United States and Europe are being hypocritical about arms control and security issues. I just wonder how you might respond to a statement like that.
I think we have a pretty well-established system in the United States government to try to monitor what kind of weapons are being sold and which to take into account concerns both of regional stability. Does selling certain kinds of weapons to certain countries make it more likely or less likely that a regional security balance might be upset, as well as the human rights practices of the governments concerned? And we also take into account their economic situation. I would not want to claim that everybody in every arms manufacturer in the group of countries that President Arias talked about has as thorough a system as we do, though I think the Europeans are trying to do somewhat better. And I think there's a real problem here. I mean, we're not talking, if I understand correctly, we're not talking about weapons of mass destruction. We're talking about standard weapons, which are
conventional
weapons, which nonetheless can obviously kill people. A balance needs to be struck. Countries do feel they have a need for national to be able to defend themselves. There are potential sources of conflict throughout the world on almost, I was going to say every continent, but I think Australia would have trouble finding somebody to fight on their continent, and Antarctica also, but on the others. And there's always the question, if we don't sell them, will somebody else sell them? And I think there's some there's some potential there for not doing everything we might wish we were able to do to try to see that the money by these countries was being spent more wisely. But I think I can distinguish that between the approach which we've criticized in China, which doesn't seem to take into account the destabilizing impact of much of what they're doing.
Let's take another call. Caller from Urbana, you're on Focus 580. Do you have a question for Mr. Alexis?
Yes, thank Jackson? You. I've got a comment first and then a question. The comment has, kind of reflects my concerns are more to do with the kind of things the last caller was talking about, namely the risks due to our own overt and covert actions. Last month in L.A. in a town meeting, Gore Vidal said the following, quote, although we regularly stigmatize other societies as rogue states, we ourselves have become the largest rogue state of all. We honor no treaties. We spurn international courts. We strike unilaterally wherever we choose. We give orders to the United Nations, but do not pay our dues. We bomb, invade, and subvert other states, complaining of terrorism. Our empire is now the greatest terrorist of all, unquote. Without specifics, my question is, I was just curious, within the Department of State, is anybody given the task to review our foreign policy actions to perhaps spot mistakes we might have made? And is anybody in the Department of State inclined to think that pursuing our interests across the world is inherently wrong-headed and that it antagonizes both good and bad members of the international community?
Interesting question.
I think Gore Vidal is a very accomplished literary figure, and I think there he accomplished what I would call rather extreme exaggeration. I think I would, if we had more time, I think I would be inclined to pursue, even though you said you didn't want to, the specifics of each of those allegations. I think none of what Mr. Vidal was quoted as saying is standard U.S. practice, and I think specific instances that might be brought up to try to justify each of those assertions would be worth discussing, and I think the discussion might suggest that the situation is somewhat different from what he said. With respect to how the Department of State looks at things, I mean, I don't think pursuing U.S. interests on a global basis is wrong. I think it's right. I think our interests are positive for the most part, and we need to pursue them in a fashion that makes for a positive-sum outcome rather than a zero-sum outcome, but I think we do that. The Department of State does consider almost all of the questions that are at least underlying what you say. I think all those are part of any consideration of whether to make a certain decision when confronted with a policy choice and are evaluated. We also do try to look after the fact at how things worked or didn't work, and sometimes that takes a while longer, and often those results are of more interest internally than they may be externally, but it is something that we do.
Thank you for your call. We've got several callers waiting online. We'll try to get to them. This is a caller from southeastern Illinois. You're on Focus 580. Do you have a question for Mr. Lexon?
Yes, I don't know if it's for him. I really, it's more for callers. Every time there's a guest discussing the anti-ballistic missile system, a number of people call in and talk about a bomb in a suitcase. And I was just wondering how that, if they could explain how that would work. Now, we're not talking about psychopaths here who destroy and kill for the pleasure of it, but political terrorists who have a goal. It seems to me that that in practical terms, when you come down to that bomb in the suitcase, that you're very limited with what you can do in the, with the bomb in the suitcase, and that, you know, suppose say we were going over to help Israel against an attack, and somebody comes up, we've got bombs in the suitcases, and if you don't turn back, we're going to blow those up. Okay, you turn back. You have a massive search, and you can find a needle in a haystack if you put enough people to work doing it. And you find anything that can be found if there are enough people searching for it. You find those bombs in the suitcase, you get rid of them, and you turn back around and go back over. I mean, it's not like a ballistic missile system where they've got it in their country, and it's not something that that you can locate and destroy. And one more point, and then I'll hang up. And hope you would make some comments on whether this bomb in the suitcase really would be practical. But anyway, the analogy with the drugs is not valid because there are too many people who in this country who profit from drugs who would not profit from a nuclear bombs being around, and I think there would be a united front among the upper world and the underworld in something like the country about to be blown up. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the caller has done a much better job than I would have sort of analyzing this bomb in a suitcase situation. I think that I would agree with the basic line of his argument. I just perhaps repeating something I had said earlier. The concern remains that we not be deterred from doing whatever is necessary to do to protect America's interests. And it's hard to see how a country proclaiming that it is about to explode a bomb in the United States that nobody knows about is going to have the same effect as having a ballistic missile system that everyone does know about. If I were that country, the last thing I would think would make sense would be actually to blow that bomb up, having announced that it came from them. That would be, in fact, inviting rather unfortunate consequences for themselves.
Let's take another call. We have a caller from Chicago. You're on with Focus 580 with Mr. Lexon. Do you have a question?
Well, a statement, and then I'd like a reply if possible. We presently have satellites aloft which are capable of detecting any activity the size of 10 feet or less anywhere on Earth. Why cannot that system be used to detect any missile activity anywhere abroad and stop it automatically by a warning and a threat to bomb?
Thank you very much.
Just as in the Cuban crisis, where we had less sophisticated activity, the missile activity in Cuba was detected ahead of time.
Okay, I don't think I'm probably not competent to, but I certainly don't think I should discuss the exact capabilities of U.S. Satellites.
Well, it's publicly known.
Well,
it's been printed in the press. It's public. There's no way of escaping that truth.
Okay, I think what is not the case is that whatever capabilities we have are directed against all parts of the globe at all times. We have limited resources which we try to devote to the parts of the globe where we think there's something of greatest interest or concern. Cuba was obviously a place where whatever systems we had in 1962 were going to be focused because of the concern we had about our national security, a threat emerging from that part of the world. But the basic point is I don't think, if I understood the caller's suggestion, it is once we detect missile activity that we then threaten to attack the country where we detect it. And I don't think that's a good way to go. We don't want any time we think a country is developing something that might be a threat to us to have to immediately say we're going to attack the country unless it ceases doing what we think we've detected. That would go off in the direction that Gore Vidal was quoted as deploring sometime earlier. I think, as I said before, it was quite exaggerated coming from Mr. Vidal, but I think we need an approach to the kinds of threats to U.S. national security which doesn't rely on immediately threatening an attack on another country.
Well, you can present the evidence in front of the United Nations. That would provide sufficient backup for our arguments. And, you know, I think your statement is basically an avoidance of the facts.
When you're talking about missile activity, are you talking about missile testing, or are you talking about somebody actually launching a strike?
Who, me?
Yes.
I'm talking about people building emplacements. You can detect anything the size of 10 feet or less all over the world. These satellites are circling the Earth 24 hours a day, and they can detect. Our people can detect this activity. You know, a missile, you have to put in rails to carry the missile, the material that are going to shoot off these missiles, right, and so on.
Let me ask you a question. You know, there's a quid pro quo here that works two ways. I mean, other countries can detect missiles in the United States, and are we not allowed to have these missiles also, or are we talking about only us telling other countries that they can't have them? I mean,
well,
this is within their sovereign territory. They can do what they want.
At the present time, we've already faced the danger of China and Russia. They already have, well, I don't know if China does, but certainly Russia has these emplacements, and essentially we've decided not to attack each other. But you have these smaller nations that we've been talking about all during this program, and they're just in the process of seemingly building these missile systems, and so they're not in any position to counteract anything that we were to do to preempt any possible strikes that they had in mind.
Right. That's. Thank you very much for your call. We're getting close to the end of the program here, but let me just say one thing. You know, there are questions here. If one of the reasons a lot of the nations are concerned about the National Missile Defense System is that they feel we'll be protected and nobody else will be, and they feel vulnerable. And this issue of vulnerability is one of the areas that you have to consider when you're talking about some kind of national security policy. I mean, everybody wants to feel safe. And at this point, I think Americans have a tendency to feel fairly safe, but also there's a problem with what some of the callers were talking about, the conventional threat, which is not something that's easily detectable. As you can tell by the number of calls that have been coming in, and we still have several people online that we can't even get to today, this is a very interesting topic and is one of concern to all of us. And if you want to hear more about this, with Michael Lexon, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Multilateral and Conventional Arms Control and the Bureau of Arms Control, you can go to the Foreign Policy Town Meeting that will examine national security challenges in the 21st century. And that town meeting is today at 2 p.m. in Follinger Auditorium on the south end of the UIUC Quad, and it's jointly sponsored by the U.S. Department of State and the Office of Continuing Education at the University of Illinois. Mr. Lexon is the keynote speaker there. I want to thank you, Michael, for coming in and talking with us this morning, and thank all of you for listening. I think this is an interesting topic, and I suspect you're going to get some interesting questions today at Follinger too, so in person. Once again, thanks very much, and if you come back this way, I hope to have you back.
Well, thank you very much. It's been very interesting. I wish there had been time to deal with some more questioners, but I know the Olympics are coming up next, and I'm sure the questions there will be even more interesting.
There are a lot of them. I'm Ron Yates, the head of the Department of Journalism here at the University of Illinois, and after a commodity market update and NPR News, Jay Pierce will be talking about sports and American society with Ray Essick, who is president and CEO of the Center for Sports Leadership and chairman of the United States Olympic Committee. Actually chairman of the United States Olympic Committee Athletic Performance Group, I should say. I hope you'll stay tuned. And thank you very much.